SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Playlist. I'm your host, Fiona Williams, and I'm managing editor of SBS Smoothies, and I'm joined by my co-host and SBS TV Guide editor, Nick Bassine. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Fiona. Fiona, I'm so excited about today's show, and I'll tell you why. We've got a couple of incredible interviews with a couple of incredible people, the actor Richard Jenkins and the Tick creator Ben Edlund, and we're going to be talking about Tom Cruise's American Maid, which is out in theaters now.
So there's a lot in this show, so Why don't we get into it? First up, we're going to be joined by Richard Jenkins, the Oscar-nominated star of The Visitor from a few years back, but equally the scene-stealing supporting actor of so many movies throughout history. It's probably quicker if we list the movies he's not in. Where do you start?
Huge fan.
He's come to us today because he's starring in a new series called Berlin Station, which is an espionage thriller set in Berlin, as it would happen, which is coming to SBS. A bit of a teaser for this one because it's coming to SBS on demand in December, but we thought we might just put a little bit of sizzle out there.
Yeah, get people excited.
And also because Richard Jenkins was available, so we snapped him up. So we'll tell you when Berlin Station goes live down the track. Don't you worry about that. He'll also be coming up very soon in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, which will be screening at the Venice Film Festival as we speak.
What's great about a chat with Richard Jenkins is that it's always timely because he's
pretty
in
much
500 movies and TV shows every year.
We could insert the name of the movie that's out this week.
Yes.
I love his work. He's not often the star of the film. I mean, The Visitor was the one where he got his big break and everyone realised, it's that guy. That's Richard Jenkins. I've seen him in everything. Let's put him on. Richard Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, The Playlist.
My pleasure.
So let's kick it off with what attracted you to Berlin Station?
The part, the script, the location.
Is that Berlin?
Yeah. That's Berlin.
What gave it away?
You should be a CIA.
How do you know I'm not?
Well, because you asked if it was Berlin.
We're off to a great start.
So what informs when you're going to do a TV series versus a movie? I mean, you haven't done as many series.
No. It's my first time being a regular in a series.
The 6 feet under.
Yes, 6 feet under, I was recurring. I show up once in a while. But I don't know. I mean, I like the script. I really like the part. I like the idea of it. I like the fact that it was today. It wasn't like, you know, CIA 20 years ago or something, or CIA in the future. Mm. I like the idea of shooting in Berlin.
Sure.
So, and I had some time on my hands, and I said, okay, I'll do this.
You can do that. And tell us a bit about Stephen Frost. I mean, he certainly seems to wear the weight of working in the spy game on his shoulders. Looks like it takes a lot out of him. What's your way into Stephen?
Well, he's at a crossroads with his life. Does he want to keep doing this? Is he getting too old to do this? Is there a career advancement? Is it a possibility? Does he love it? He's not sure. He's just kind of at a place where he's been doing it for so long, and it's new now. Everything is, you know, it's not boots on the ground. It's a lot of computerized stuff, and intelligence is changing, and he's in an odd place. Plus, he has some personal issues that are going on that don't help.
Sorry if I mean, it's almost obligatory at this point for anybody to ask how a movie or TV show relates to Trump, but the current administration seems to have an antipathy towards the intelligence community. Does that inform the series at all, or will it, or?
Well, the first season, when you walk into this station, you see a picture of President Obama and Vice President Biden. This year, when you walk into this station, there's a picture of Trump and Mike Pence. It does. But the question is, how do you do it? That's the question. And that was, you know, and I think it's pretty great the way they've found a way into this world, what's going on today. The problem with a series like this, I mean, we actually talked about the Paris bombings last year when they happened while we were shooting. But if you try to make your series about current events, you'll never get anywhere because things happen every day. And so how do you make sure that people understand that this stuff is happening today and we're aware of the world and we're part of the world? And I think that season two, I just think it was really smart what they did. But I can't tell you.
Right.
We'll just have to watch it. I think Berlin Station sort of makes an interesting companion piece to Burn After Reading. I think that might have been your last foray into spy territory. Not that you played the spy in it. But
the Berlin Station, the folks are a little smarter.
Yeah. Well, I hope so.
I hope. I mean, God, I hope. We don't have Brad Pitt's character.
That's serious three.
Burn After Reading, there was really no redeeming human being in the entire movie.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no human being in equality, which made it fantastic. Yeah. But Berlin Station is a kind of a serious attempt at the CIA.
You've done so much, and personally...
And you're getting sick of it, aren't you?
Well, give it a rest already.
No, keep it coming.
Good
keep it coming.
Lord.
Didn't you educate my kids? You know what I'm saying?
Personally, my favorite stuff is aside from 6 Feet Under, is the comedies. There's Something About Mary, Step Brothers, Flirting with Disaster. I just love you in those movies. But having done so much, so many varied roles, are there things that you think back on that where you think, yeah, that one was really fantastic or that was really special?
Those three you mentioned. I mean, I didn't do much in Mary. I just was.
It's so funny, though. I think about it all the time.
It is. It's fun. It's fun. Yeah. Flirting. I love Flirting with Disaster. I just loved it. And Step Brothers. My God, it was just crazy fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do. Sometimes it takes a while for you to look back, and that's what you do. You look back. You say, oh. That's pretty good.
Right.
When you see something after you've done it 15, 20 years ago or even 30 years ago, you've forgotten it. So you can almost watch it fresh. You don't have memories of, I wish I'd done this scene differently or, you know. So I think I saw Flirting about 2 years ago. And it's really
hold
good.
Up?
I think it does, yeah.
Well, on that, I rewatched Hannah and Her Sisters recently and I forgot you were in that. And I went, oh. There's Richard Jenkins.
I forgot I was in it too.
And given you are in so many films and sometimes you forget about it, what are your fan interactions like? Sort of what are the movies that you get that get referenced when people bump into you?
It depends on the age. If you're young guys, it's almost always Step Brothers. The Visitor I get a lot. Yeah. Olive Kitteridge.
That's great.
They'll say, "Oh my God, I loved," and they'll name a movie that I did in 1986 or something. But you usually can tell with the age group, you know, or the kind of person that comes up, or they'll come up to you and they say, "How do I know you?"
You do the work.
I say, "You don't know me. what have I?" What have I seen you in? I was like, I don't know what you've seen. What do you mean? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm in everything.
but you know, people are great. I mean, they're fun and appreciative. I mean, that's why we do this job. So it's not finished until somebody watches it. And if somebody takes the time to say, I really like that, that's great.
Did you get sick of people asking what Telly Savalas is like?
Well, there's not a lot of people ask me. But.
Oh, really? That's surprising. That was going to be my first question.
What is Telly Savalas like? Well, actually, Telly Savalas, I can't tell you what he did because it's just too blue. But
Oh, wait, now you have to tell us.
Hilarious. Yeah. No, I can't.
Save it for the memoir.
But I really liked him. He was great. Great guy. I think he lived in a hotel his entire life.
Is that right?
Well, I think at the time, yeah, I don't know if his entire life, but he was living in a hotel, you know?
At the Chateau Marmont or something.
Deal, man. You get room service all the time? I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's a good deal.
But Kelly Savalas.
I understand you've directed a lot of theatre. Are you interested in directing a film or a TV program at all?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Case closed.
No. Well, no, my brain doesn't work like that. You know, theater is, you know, a process. You really can discover as you go. You know, movies, you're on a set for a day and you move on. Mm. And so, you know, it doesn't mean you don't have time to explore stuff. But as a director, you have to have an idea of what this movie is and how you want it to look and be. And I don't think that way. So, I've been offered to do a small film here or there, but no, it's not me.
So we're a culture podcast. We like to ask our guests what they've been watching lately. What have you been watching?
Well, I was in Berlin, so I had no TV. So I was watching.
Do they not have TVs in Berlin?
Gunsmoke. Right. Yeah, but it's in German, and this wouldn't help me.
So reruns of Gunsmoke.
Again, you're not with the CIA, are you?
This is your burn after reading type scenario.
Because I grew up as a kid watching, and then it just took me back, and I loved Dennis Weaver. I thought Dennis Weaver was, as a kid watching this guy, it was like, what is this really interesting, this character this guy's created? So I watched a lot of those, and then I watched Handmaiden's Tale.
Yes.
Which I really liked. And I watched the last season of Fargo, which I loved.
Oh,
I always do. Michael Stuhlbarg was in it. He's terrific in it. And I just did a movie with him. So it was nice to see that.
You'd be good on that show. Your sensibility.
It's a great series. Yeah, it's a great series. It's just really smart.
Yeah.
It's really smart. And what else? Man, that's just kind of... Oh, and I watch, since I'm home, my wife is a choreographer. And we watch So You Think You Can Dance.
Oh.
You know the show?
Yes. Yes, we get that here too.
It's pretty beautiful. It's pretty beautiful. These kids, young people, young men and women, who come from one background, some hip-hop, some contemporary dance, some ballet, some ballroom, some Latin, you know, all the different kinds of stuff. And they have to do other styles. And you see the growth of these young dancers over, you know, a 10, 12-week period. And it's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing.
Oh,
wow. So I like that. I have always liked that. I love that show. But that's about it, because I didn't have access to a lot of things in Germany to watch.
Sure.
So, and Berlin Station. I was watching Berlin Station.
Oh, yeah,
sure. One of the finest pieces of television ever writ.
No question.
Have you seen German movies?
Nine. No, I haven't seen nine of them. No, I haven't.
Wow. Well.
You know what I wanted. I wanted to see the Berliner Ensemble production of Three Penny Opera, Bertolt Brecht play. But I just always missed it. They revive it every year, and I never caught it. That's what I wanted to see. Oh. But you know, someday maybe.
Yeah.
What'd you do for fun in Berlin if you weren't watching TV?
Explored the city, you know, went to some great restaurants, played a little golf a couple of times, you know, had dinner with friends, which basically the cast, you know, and the crew, and it was fun. And I actually came home three times this year. Last year I didn't, but it was my son got married, so I
congratulations.
Came home for that, and I was actually home. Thank you. So it was a little more civilized this year. I got to come home, spend a few weeks here, and then go back. So it was great.
Mm. And we'll be seeing you soon on screen in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. Are you heading to Venice for the premiere?
I am, yes. We're going to Venice, and then from Venice we head directly to Telluride. Oh. take a couple of days off and then go to Toronto, and then in October go to London. So,
all right. Yeah. Next couple of months are set for you. Yeah. What can you tell us about that film?
Oh, God, it's a beautiful movie. That's all I can tell you. It's a beautiful movie. Mm. Guillermo del Toro is just, I mean, you know, at my age, to be able to get a chance to work and do some of the stuff I've been able to do, and one of the things to work with Guillermo on this film has just been amazing. But it's a story of this young woman. Have you seen the trailer?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, this story of this young woman who's mute, and she's a cleaning person in this government installation, and she meets this creature, and they start communicating. And it's a love story. It's amazing. It's an amazing love story. And I play her friend, her next-door neighbor, who's an artist for ad agencies, and we're dear friends, but she asked me to help her save this creature. And, you know, I'm trying to not give it any more away than the trailer does, but I think that's pretty much it. And got a wonderful cast, Sally Hawkins, Michael Shannon, Octavia Spencer, and Michael Stuhlbarg. I mean, wonderful group of people, fabulous performances. And I love this movie. I just love it.
Oh, great. Yeah,
It reminds me of a Hollywood movie. It reminds me, I said to Guillermo, this is like Frank Capra if he did a genre picture. Mm. It reminds me of the 40s in movies. The story is big. It's a big idea. It's a huge idea, but it's not. It's a small idea. It's, you know, acceptance and love but it's not an issue oriented movie. It's like old school for some reason for me. And the way he shoots, the beauty of the sets, the look of the film, it's how I kind of saw movies in the 40s and 30s actually. So. I just think it's wonderful. I think it's his best film in a long time.
Sure. Yeah, it does look like it sort of connects.
I hope people agree with me, you know.
Yeah. It looks like it connects back to Pan's Labyrinth in some ways, sort of the war connection and the fantasy elements as well.
It is a fantasy, but it's grounded in such humanity with the characters, the actors. It's really beautifully nuanced, I think. I mean, the way he tells the story he does some things in it that just my jaw dropped. I knew you were shooting that, but I had no idea that's how you were going to do it. That's how you would put it together. He's one of a kind. Mm. One of a kind. You should talk to him sometime.
Oh,
we'd
love
to. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Put in a good word for us.
Yeah.
he's just so interesting. He's such an interesting dude. Yeah.
Do you think Kong Skull Island has been unfairly criticized?
I think every movie I'm in has been unfair.
I really liked it. I had a good
time. I just saw Kong Skull Island, and I liked it.
It's fun.
It is fun. I was rooting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Look, we would love to talk to you all day, quite frankly.
We could really just go through your IMDb profile and ask you a million questions.
And say, how about that one? Look, honestly, it's been such a pleasure. We're big fans.
Yes.
Truly.
Thank you so much for making the time. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it was fun, guys. Thanks for asking me.
Thank you. All the best. Bye-bye.
Well, that was Richard Jenkins.
It sure was.
Fantastic.
He was fun.
Really funny. Fun person to talk to.
And as we mentioned, Berlin Station is coming to SBS On Demand soon. And stay tuned. We'll let you know.
And next up, we've got Ben Edlund, who is the creator of The Tick, which began as a comic book, was adapted into an animated series, a Saturday morning animated series in 1994, which ran for 3 seasons. It was then adapted into a live-action version in 2001, starring Patrick Warburton from Seinfeld. And it's been 16 years. The latest adaptation is on Amazon Prime. It's available now. And it's a really interesting, weird blend of superhero comedy and real sorrow and loss. So we're here with Ben Edlund. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
So for a good portion of our audience, The Tick might be kind of new. And it's also, it's a difficult to... It doesn't fit into a simple whole. No. Simple genre, right? It's a few different things. It's a lot of things to a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could kind of reduce it pretty from a distance to it's superhero comedy. Okay. But that's such a weird sort of subgenre unto itself.
What else is in that genre?
You know, to me, that's got a history of, I mean, well, specifically live action superhero comedy is a very interesting world that has things like The Greatest American Hero, American TV series, or right. Mystery Men is a good
Men,
example
we were just talking
of,
about
you know,
that.
Something like that. I think that TV has played around a little bit with it. I think Deadpool is considered, you know, superhero comedy. Even like, I'd say... But there's a difference because Deadpool connects with the Marvel Universe and sort of serious canon, so it only has a certain latitude, comedically speaking. So it's a superhero comedy, but it is. It's actually tonally a weird hybrid. It was designed to kind of just sort of be a bunch of things. Like, I want to have fun with superheroes. I want to have fun making fun of this cultural saturation that's really we're at a point of fatigue with superheroes. Sorry, I've got a superhero show too. but this one feels like it's about superheroes. It's about the phenomenon in a way, to a degree. I mean, that's always been the position of the Tick, is to kind of be sort of observing the deeper kind of mechanics a little bit while we're just sort of having goofy fun.
You know, it's your baby. Tell us how it happened and watching it through its various incarnations of...
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's... And my baby is old now.
Your baby's all grown up.
All grown up. It's like a 31-year-old blue golem. yeah, I mean, that's a long relationship to have with a fictional character. And in this particular universe, you know, I created it as a comic book. That was in the 80s. That was at a time when I was very young. I started working on this character when I was 17. So that was a very unfiltered kind of just humorous and warm response to the fun I was having enjoying superheroes and starting to realize, well, they're kind of silly, but they're also sacred. So I had those kind of conflicting feelings about them, you know, at that time. That went into the work, and that became the comic book, independent comic book that started to kind of take off in the late 80s. Gave me the opportunity to enter into cartooning, Saturday morning cartoons, because we sold it as a cartoon. And that was it being what it was supposed to be at that time, an independent comic book that followed the track of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from a small regional expression to something that was like a massive corporate, you know, enjoyment of this thing. We sort of did the cult version of that. So we had 3 seasons of the cartoon. It was a very odd bird to be out there on Saturday morning. That's been the tradition of the Tick every time, is to sort of be unexpectedly overwrought in some ways and like infused with a lot of almost Fabergé egg kind of like detail work and thinking. And then also to sort of be in one way or another a reflection of the superhero tropes and conventions of its time. And that's kind of what we're doing again.
In the latest version, the duality of the absurd superhero stuff, mm-hmm. with the very serious mental illness, post-traumatic stress disorder type stuff.
Yeah.
Like that's very heavily juxtaposed, maybe more than previously, right?
I'd say, for sure. The gulf between the funny and the absurd, the absurd and the dramatic, and the things we're sort of trying to put into the same piece. There are some, tonally speaking, some very... like kind of a high wire act of including darkness, including kind of really a bit melancholy, really dark and melancholy material, and things that like as much as it might be absurd in the context of our goofy half hour, it chronicles real loss, like real amputating emotional loss of people in one's life and the kind of things that we're sort of facing that are not light comedy, you know? And so I don't know where we get off. I don't know what we're thinking. I mean, like, it has a lot of it's just that I wanted to do a show with these characters who have lasted for some reason for this period of time and become kind of iconic in this funny little relationship between the Tick and Arthur, and their sort of attempt to help the world has been a 30-year story. I wanted that to kind of have substance. And I think it's always been sort of floating around in the milk of the hero myth kind of stuff. And it just became important to, I don't know, I think I'm rambling. Thanks for having me over.
It's
good.
But it became important.
Let's start over.
Let's start again, shall we? Just really, this is not just fluff, which is weird. I don't know why I chose to do that, but it's got some weight, and we'll see what that means.
Well, I'm trying to think of other things that mix absurdity with such depths of such seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything.
To me, the models that drove me, and I will not claim to, we'll work on it. We'll see if we can bring something to you that is of this, you know, level of excellence. But to me, like, Dr. Strangelove is a really good example of...
Yeah, right.
So intensely absurd. Those moments when you're with, is it Sterling Hayden and... I can't remember the name. Like, well, just the war room moments.
Yeah. Right.
You know, with George C. Scott. All the moments.
You can't
all of
fight
them.
In
Slim
the
Pickens
room.
Riding a nuclear missile down into the...
Yeah.
You know, beautiful and nuts and dealing with the most dark material you could, at that time especially, because the fear and dread of a nuclear devastation was almost too, it was too much to joke about. And if you've seen Failsafe, which is kind of the movie kind of comes from, they're not joking at all. Like, that's dark. On the beach, Failsafe, you know, all that stuff. Alas, Babylon, that was a time when they were not joking around. And that is absurdist humor and fun every other moment. So that's a model that I'd love to achieve one day.
Not a bad one.
Yeah.
If you're going to...
Aspirations. Yeah. That's what I came here to talk about.
And I guess, you know, like you say, you've been with this character for, 30-odd years.
Mm-hmm.
How is it now writing as an adult, but when you were with it as a teenager, sort of, and coming to those themes, and how have you changed, and has your approach changed
the show? I mean, when I started, really, it was, I think unfiltered is the word that makes sense to me. Like, I was a kid really just resonating and making stuff. And I had my own point of view on it. And I thought, oh, this is silly or this is fun. It would be fun to make fun of this. But one of the things that you gain and lose, I don't know, you gain experience, you gain an understanding of the craft and art that you're involved in. And then your awareness starts to mess with the innocent, easy, broad strokes of creation that you were involved in as a younger person. So the danger is to overthink everything. Basically, I just allowed myself to overthink everything at this point. I just decided, all right, what happens if you really overthink everything? And so that has arrived with a Tick story that has an intrinsic sort of self-contained mythology. Like, there's, if we, and we hope to be able to, create multiple seasons of this and follow a story. It's actually like a story that's got a beginning, middle, and end, and it's about itself. I think a lot of these things sort of open a free jazz riff in the superhero universe that it opens. I've gone from first being kind of more random to a point where now I've got a goal narratively, and we've got what started out as a sort of almost a sketchbook of ideas and to make fun of the superhero kind of tropes around me. Now it's the story of Tick and Arthur, characters I've lived with for a long time, characters who seem to be stepping into a reality that's a little bit more involved and nuanced than they've ever had. I'm intrigued. I don't know. We'll see.
The adaptations of the Tick have come at it in different phases of cultural evolution.
Yeah.
Right? So what you were satirizing in the 90s would be different to 2001, would be different to now.
Mm-hmm.
What are the differences there, and what are the challenges there?
Yeah.
I
think one thing that's interesting is this is a world so much more educated on superheroes, and with a little bit more of a sense that superheroes have kind of invaded their world. I think that that's created an environment that's different than when we started, so that we can make a lot of jokes about superheroes and just sort of take it sort of as a norm for everybody. Where when I first started, I really felt like what I was doing was making something that was kind of designed as the cartoon especially, designed to kind of pass as just another one of these cartoons, but then have these strange little sort of signals of oddness and kind of unusual like choices inside it that were designed to be kind of like secret signals to other people who felt a little off or felt a little bit different. And it's something that to me, when I was young, I would receive those signals. I would see something and watch something and get really excited by the fact that somebody was weird. They were willfully weird. We just mentioned Dr. Strangelove. I mean, obviously, that's a lot of signals. But I mean, for me, I remember seeing a run of Saturday morning cartoon called, by Ralph Bakshi and Chris Felucci, John Chris Felucci. It was called Mighty Mouse. And
yeah,
it was very impactful to me because the minds behind that were not establishment-tested and secured minds. Those were very unusual minds that were expressing themselves in completely what felt like both acceptable on the surface but completely unfettered in some other way, you know, subversive, like intent being played out there. I think that's a through line. Each era and each expression of this tick has kind of used the fabric of its stuff. So Saturday morning cartoon, we use the same animating houses and the companies involved in making sort of straight stuff. We use those as the tools. What's interesting now is Amazon Prime is offering us the chance to, we're using the most like really aggressive, strong effects. And like, this is where we've been the most, I think, convincingly able to like make a superhero adventure story that has humor as one of its elements. Anyway, each era has been a different experiment.
Mm. And I want to talk about the fans as well. I mean, because you've got a very dedicated fan base and who, you know, championed at various incarnations.
Very grateful to that dedicated fan base to help for helping us get to this place. Yeah,
sure. What are your fan interactions like? And sort of what are some weird ones, funny ones? Who's fans?
I remember a long time ago, my fan interactions, you know, that was fan mail. And that was, you know, something that one guy sent me his shoe in the mail. I was like, size 13 shoe. I'm glad that he was a distance away and he was just sending a shoe. Always had very good I thought, really lovely people enjoying the tick. Kind of the signal of weirdness seems to unlock, I think, interesting, you know, resonance. But one of the things that's taking place now because of the longevity of this character, and this is very enjoyable and kind of profound, is I have people, I'll go to a comic book convention or sit somewhere and sign some comic books. And a young person, maybe in their 20s, will come up and a male or female will tell me that their parents made them watch The Tick when they were kids, the cartoon. And they have the experience because there was something that the parents were seeing in it that they enjoyed, and it was, they really describe it as a moment of a family, you know, enjoying something together. Or specifically, it's usually one parent, and a lot of times it can be like the father and son or father and daughter, but they really enjoy, they like something I made is part of their experience. Like for me, it was the Muppet Show with my family, for example, like where we would just all, it all clicked with us and we just enjoyed it together. This is something that's taken place in people's lives. They bring back that information to me. Somehow to be a part of that situation is way more fulfilling than I ever thought I would, you know. That's great.
Sure.
It's fantastic.
When you talk about, you mentioned the silly and the sacred of the silliness, sacredness of superheroes, that's kind of reflected in fandom as well. Mm-hmm. The way fans react to any kind of messing with an iconic character or any deviation. Yeah. But you would be in a kind of a nice sweet spot maybe where the fans take it seriously, but they know it's super silly. Like they get what you're doing.
Yes, ideally. that's what I wanted, and that was the risk here, I think, in doing another series with this. Each time you go back out, even if it's me, because I did each one, so there's a certain authenticity that's kind of irrefutable in a way. But I was very anxious about whether or not fans would embrace this new version. There's a lot of love for the previous live-action version and a lot of just kind of...
Do they get angry?
So I was worried about that, you know, and I think that the most sort of upset or disappointment took place in anticipation of this new series when it was understood that Patrick Warburton wouldn't be returning to that role. And he's a producer on the show, and we've been engaged in bringing the show back. But all of us agreed this is going to be a brand new expression and it's time to have a new sort of everything. That was a risk, and all of the risks associated with kind of creating a new tonal index for this show, it could have been embraced or not embraced by all these people who have a reason to care before they see this thing. And that was my worry. And I'd say mostly it's been embraced, actually. I couldn't have asked for a higher percentage of the fans. You know, I wouldn't have. This is a great number. And I feel like if people watch and they hear more about it, then people might warm up who haven't. But really a great number of fans have gotten behind us and gotten behind some of the interesting tonal choices we've made.
Because you would hear about it. With Twitter.
Well, we've heard. Yeah. Like, I mean, I definitely have heard and read, I mean, like a lot of negative feedback about it. And tend to often agree. You know, just go, oh, yeah, well, that's a point. I absolutely see that.
Noted.
Yeah. And I think often it's a question of whether or not it was just too much for them and they just went, I didn't want this. And I said, that's fine. I get it. But in a lot of cases, such support, such happiness that it's come back, so they're really happy to see the fun maybe they remember this character and this setup having with superheroes, that we're able to have that fun at this time, which feels like a kind of endless playground of constructs to pervert.
Well said.
Do you have strong feelings about how superhero culture has evolved and how we're inundated with superhero movies? And that seems to be the main,
it's a very strange time. I feel like it's a very weird and suspicious turn of events, like this degree of infatuation and like kind of boundless appetite for superhero fiction. For us, maybe nothing since Westerns was as pervasive in terms of, like, you know, there was a time when if you wanted to say, like, if you look at certain movies of a certain time and they wanted to express, okay, television is on in the next room, it would be the sound of guns and people yelling and horse hooves. And that was, oh, well, that's television for 1955, right? Really, if we were going to do television's on in the next room right now, you'd hear a cape flapping and you'd hear some kind of, you know, you'd hear superheroes. Yeah. You'd hear superhero rousing music. So what is it? And to me, like, and this is analysis beyond I've never really finished a higher education sort of study. But anyway, like, I do feel that something happened in World War II that made Westerns the thing. You know what I mean? Like, there was a wounding of the psyche, and then there was a catharsis in the idea of... I think there are reasons for that level of saturation. I think there are reasons for this level of saturation that we're going through, and I think the idea of superhero, it's about something like instead of it being like, oh, I wish I had that kind of power, now it's more like, wow, I think we have that kind of power. What are we doing to ourselves, to the planet, to, like, our own, the structures of our lives, like internet, all these things, we don't even know the power we've already exerted over what was supposed to be, you know, we're all kind of in, we can all remember, internet was not it. It was not part of our existence. We were not wiring our planet with an artificial nervous system that was going to make central what was once disparate. You know, like, it's big stuff. And we weren't aware there was a continent-sized island of plastic that we had put into the ocean that is, you know, I mean, our power is godlike. So there's something going on, and I think this is not about wish fulfillment. It's like, and you notice that superhero expression now is angst-ridden. It's not about, I'm just going to fly and I'll fight a big robot and it'll be simple and we'll be done. Mm. It's after that. It's about what are the implications of my actions and the consequences of my capacity, you know? Anyway, I don't know if those are strong feelings. That's a number of feelings.
You got me. Yeah.
Fantastic.
We usually like to wrap things up.
I think otherwise we'd be here forever.
We like to ask guests what they've been watching. I have a dual interest, generally what you're watching, but also because Fiona and I were talking about, for a non-superhero fan, how does The Tick appeal? And I was thinking fans of absurdist comedy.
Yes.
And so I was wondering if you could tell us about some of your inspiration and the stuff you love in absurdist comedy.
For sure.
And then what you've been watching more generally.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say that I have a very simple... a very simple answer to that because it was so impactful, like Monty Python early on for me.
Yeah, there you go.
And before I really understood the differences between what was supposed to be tragic and funny, I just ended up, my parents brought me to Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I think I was probably about 7.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I had art school parents, and they were like, oh, we'll go see this movie. When the Black Knight is getting all his limbs cut off, and then he says, come back here and I'll bite you. Like, and the blood, it's so much blood.
Yes, it's quite graphic.
That it was, I think that was sort of a weird kind of baptismal moment for me.
Cool.
Of, absurdism and how scary and nightmarish it can be and how the reprieve of humor and you realize the universe has different rules to it. Something about that was really powerful to me. I think maybe a little bit more of a literary and more subtle version of that was Kurt Vonnegut and his writing.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of had some of the same kind of violent absurdism, but it was more invisible. And those things did a lot to kind of, I mean, there are many, many other things, but those were very important.
What about now?
Well, what comes to mind for me that's of late that I've seen that really kind of struck me that way, Maria Bamford's show, Lady Dynamite, is like a show that, I don't know if you saw the whole show.
I watched the whole series.
Like, it ends up with a guinea pig driving a robot that is, like, inside Maria Bamford's head, and she's playing kind of like a Power Ranger, and she's fighting the lead singer from, is it Blink-182? I forget. Anyway.
That's
and you're still kind of like, I hope things turn out okay for her.
You do you, Maria. You do
you. You keep going. I hope that all works out, your struggle with mental health.
Yeah.
That's some real wonderful absurdism. Because you care about her story and it's out the window in terms of the fun that it's having.
Yeah,
itself.
And down the street and around
down
the block.
Down the street, running naked with a weird hat.
Yeah.
Well,
Benedict, thank you. It has been illuminating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been great.
And how can we watch The Tick?
You can watch it on August 25th. It explodes worldwide on Amazon Prime Video. That's how you can watch it. You can watch the first 6 episodes of a 12-episode season. We're going to release the first 6 now, and then next year, in a number of months, we'll release the second half. We're really excited to see what everyone thinks.
Brilliant. Cool. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Ben Edlund. How good was he?
He was great. So nice.
And thoughtful. Very good. Great.
Ben also happens to be a big fan of Batman, the Adam West version, which heavily informed The Tick.
Hmm.
And you can hear more
from Ben and us, in fact, on Batman Land, another podcast in our little network, which comes out Fridays to coincide with the episodes of Batman on SBS Viceland.
And now we've come to the part of the show that is, I would say, is the most buzzed about. And it's got the most cachet in terms of just hot podcast conversation. What have you been watching? Fiona, what have you been watching?
I've been watching American Made.
Me too.
Ah, ding, ding. We should have conferred. So this is in cinemas now. Tom Cruise. Your man, Tom.
Oh.
Tommy C.
Tommy C.
It's his newie, where he is playing Barry Seal, a pilot who is recruited by the CIA, just go with us here, to fly reconnaissance missions into Central America in the 70s/80s, Reagan's America, and ends up enabling the Pablo Escobar drug cartel, his gun running to the Nicaraguans, this wild chapter of American history. True story, might I add.
Quite a story.
It's quite a scene. I really enjoyed the film. Directed by Doug Liman, who Tom worked with on Edge of Tomorrow, which I thought was an underrated film.
Very fun.
From a couple of years back. So they're back together in American Made. What did you think?
I was not familiar with the history. I didn't know who this guy was. I mean, I knew about the Iran-Contra situation, and I knew about Pablo Escobar and the
drugs
and the drug cartel. But I didn't know Barry Seal's story, and I think that this was, I mean, it's not born on the 4th of July, but I think it combines what's fun about Tom Cruise. He's at his sunglass-wearing, plane-flying, movie star best. Charisma for days. But there's an undercurrent of danger and doom.
Is there ever? Yes.
And some critics thought that it was superficial, but I don't think so. I think because of the danger and because of what happens to people that do these kinds of things, all of the charisma and flying by the seat of your pants, all of that stuff, it comes at a price.
Oh, yeah. And I think what's great about this role for Tom, I mean, he's normally, you know, Mr. Cruise Control, and he's at the center of all this, and he seems to know what's going on, and it's all his journey. But here, he doesn't know what's going on. It's all wild. It's like, okay, CIA wants to recruit me. Is this legal? What am I? Okay.
Is he a fool? He's kind of a fool, right? Or he's foolish?
It's dumb luck. I think he falls into all these situations and makes the most of them. Does he ever? Like, he becomes wildly rich. There's a lot of cash in suitcases.
He's so
lucky. Ground. Yeah. But always with this risk, and you think of the consequences and the potential dangers, and that's what works here. And I can't take credit for this theory, but I think it was Variety that looked at the film and said, this is the Top Gun sequel that I want. Kind of like if this was Maverick
20,
30 years on, you know, the timelines don't quite work because this is grounded in actual history. But, you know, if this was Maverick, wound up working for TWA as a pilot but needs money to feed his family, so gets recruited to do these weird flights, private jet down to Central America, you know, that would be great. But I sort of connected it like a Catch Me If You Can, kind of one of those wild stories that, but this one's a red state one, so there's a couple of Confederate flags and whatnot. This is in Alabama.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, like a red state Catch Me If You Can, if you will.
Yeah. It's just a great pop entertainment with some serious life lessons involved. like Catch Me If You Can. Yeah, that's a great comparison, I think. I really enjoyed it. It really stuck with me, especially the ending. I thought it was great. Mm. Everybody's good in it. I really like Donald Gleason. He's in every movie now.
Again. Mm.
But he was really good.
He's sort of the shadowy, is he CIA? Where's he from? What's his story?
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah, comes in at various intervals.
Do you think people still hold Scientology against Tom Cruise in terms of either what they think of him or how it plays out in the box office?
In a previous episode, we talked about The Mummy, and we liked it. Apparently, we're the only two people in the world who did, or other than Tom Cruise and maybe Suri. Honestly, I think that film got an unfair backlash. I think a lot of people were prepared to hate it beforehand, and it wasn't perfect.
Right.
But honestly, I don't know if it's just Scientology, but there's a bit of Tom fatigue, I think. I think there's a wave, especially on Twitter. There's a innate cynicism with him. I don't know. Look, I hope that doesn't happen with this film because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than The Mummy, for sure. I think it's a better film. But as long as people give it a chance and realise it's not the Tom Cruise film that you're used to seeing, it ain't Top Gun. It goes to some darker places.
I feel like people still think about couch jumping and the Matt Lauer interview, and that's still sort of top of mind,
it's all there.
I mean, it's weird to be put in the position to try to defend movie stars, but it feels unfair to me.
I think that's a burden you choose to bear.
It is.
You are a Top Cruise apologist. We've gone there before.
It's a great movie. Everybody should see it.
Related point, since you brought it up, Going Clear.
Yes.
Scientology.
It's on SBS On
it's
Demand.
It's currently screening on SBS On Demand, streaming even.
Great documentary.
Yeah, for a short time. So when you finish listening to this, go stream it. Which gets into the weeds on Tom.
And when it first came out, people were saying that Tom should have denounced some of the shadier aspects
of some of the shocking revelations that come out in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think Tom Cruise should come forward and make a comment about the fake butt controversy? Let me hear the sigh.
We're going there, are we? Which film was that again?
Valkyrie.
Valkyrie, right. I've seen an image. I've not.
So he's thrown to the ground and there's a still of him where he has an enormous butt. And nobody knows where it comes from.
Look, of all the things that Tom has to come out and talk about as a moral obligation, I think the fake butt in Valkyrie is lower on my list. But
well, when we get him on the show,
yeah,
that'll be one of my first questions.
I'd like to vet that list before we put it to him. But okay, if we have time.
American Made is out in the theaters now. We both liked it. See what you think.
Maybe you will too. Now, we wouldn't be doing our jobs properly if we didn't touch on the fact that as this podcast comes out, it is 20 years since the death of Diana, the Princess of Wales. I mention that because across SBS and SBS On Demand, we're doing a special week of programming around that.
Royal Week. So documentaries focused on Diana, so Diana in her own words, Diana versus Elizabeth, which explored her relationship with the Queen, and then general royal docs like The Royals Who Rescued the Monarchy, Spying on the Royals. There's so much inside Kensington Palace.
So a lot of programming looking at the role of royals in contemporary life and throughout history.
Right.
There's more information at the guide, sbs.com.au/guide, if you want the full lineup. But I guess it being 20 years,
it was big
deal at the time.
Certainly.
Where were you when you found out?
I was driving from New York to Philadelphia to see my now ex-girlfriend. And my parents called, and I think to talk about something else. And then my father said, I don't know if we should tell him the news. He might crash the car. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, Princess Diana died. I thought it was interesting and said a lot about what my father thought of me, that that he thought that I would be so distraught that I would drive myself off the road at hearing the news. But yeah, that's where I was.
Mm.
What about you?
Well, I remember this. It was quite a visual way to find out. A friend of mine was moving out of home at the time, that's sort of the age we were, and she was buying a television set and I was helping her with the selection process. So we were in a department store, the bank of televisions on the wall, and we were looking at, you know, pixel resolution and dimensions. And then finally she said, Fiona, look at what's on the televisions right in front of us. So it was, on multiple screens right in front. So, yeah, that was quite a...
That's extremely cinematic.
It was, wasn't it? Yes. Yeah.
Now, our producer Jeremy, I don't want to oversell it, but he has maybe the best story.
I haven't heard this one.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Yeah, so I actually didn't find out about the death of Princess Diana for many months. I was actually kind of living as a bit of a recluse, not really living as a recluse, but I was very disconnected from the rest of the world in a little town you may know called Dunoon. Shout out to all my expats from Dunoon, the macadamia capital of Australia. I was living out there, wasn't watching television, wasn't listening to the radio. I was just sort of in my own little world. As I was, and all of my friends that I was hanging out with just were not at all talking about royals or Diana or current news events. No, it was more about...
It was all about nuts.
It was all about nuts and the kind of underground rock and roll scene of Lismore, to be honest with you. So I didn't find out for months, and then there was sort of post all the headlines and stuff, it was more like the... I finally turned on the television and they were still talking about it months later, but it was in a much different tone. And I was like, but they're kind of talking about her like she's dead. Oh, she died? Right.
And there you have it.
Heard it here first. Okay, that may have been oversold. That's a way to... It missed you.
Yeah, I think that's great. And now, 20 years later, you can turn on the TV and see a bunch of stuff about...
Yeah, don't wait a couple of months on this one.
No. that about wraps it up.
Sure does. Thanks for listening. We're going to put some notes about the episode online with recommended links to the shows and movies we've been talking about. Make sure you subscribe and give us a review wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you have any questions, get in touch with SBS Movies on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can find me on Twitter at anythingbutfifi.
I'm on Twitter at Nick Bassine.
Why do people want to be at work? To feel heard, appreciated, part of something, and to know there's a career path for everyone. Inclusive workplaces are linked to increased innovation, productivity, and employee satisfaction. Make your organization a place where people want to be. For inclusion and diversity training, visit inclusion-program.com.au.